Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. We begin with our roundtable of WFPL reporters, as we were going to do last week. We'll do it again this week. Political editor Philip M. Bailey, environment reporter Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama, who covers education and many other issues, including amusement park openings. We'll start with in just a moment. We want to hear from you as well. 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. Toll-free 1-877-814-TALK. That's 877-814-8255. Send us an email at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet at WFPL News or reach us through Facebook. Well, Devin, Bluegrass Boardwalk had made some news this week. Of course, that's going to be the new entity that will take over the Kentucky Kingdom property.
The much-anticipated amusement park that's been vacant since late 2010. Yeah, they received preliminary approval for the state tax incentives, which was a huge step for them to move forward with the project. They received preliminary approval for about $4 million, which their initial investment was about $15 million, most of that coming from a private lending group. So what happens now is essentially the state or the Tourism Development Finance Authority will ask for an economic impact study to be done. And in order for them to get these tax incentives, they have to meet certain goals, such as 25% of their visitors have to be from out of state within the first 4 years. There's certain job growth that has to happen. They basically have to prove to the state that the state's investment is worthy. And so they received preliminary approval for the next 2 months. They're actually going to be getting a third party to review the grounds and review the plans and make sure everything's secure.
Now, the plan is to reopen the park next year?
Right? Yeah, and it was a little unclear. A couple weeks ago, that we were getting word from Bluegrass Boardwalk. They said that they are a little bit behind schedule, or behind where they'd like to be, is what they actually said. But they're still on schedule to open in May, which was what they were initially thinking the time that they were open. So that's not behind schedule. I think what they were referring to at the time was that their schedule to be approved for these tax incentives were a little bit delayed. But right now it looks like they're in line to get them.
And they're going to be open. They've committed to a specific number of days to be open.
Yeah, and that's also part of the incentive program. Right. You have to be open for at least 100 days a year in order to be approved. They said that they will be open 106 days in 2013. Starting in May, that means, you know, they'll have 106 days starting from May to the end of the year.
We've seen what they've done with these huge water rides at their facilities in Indiana. It's going to be interesting to see what they do here.
Yeah, and they're still expecting to keep the same family-style value theme park in line, which basically means free soft drinks, free sunscreen, free use of inner tubes, which might be free in other places. I'm not quite sure. I haven't been to a amusement park in a while.
Okay, well, it sounds like a lot of fun. And we always, this time of year, we start hearing is when is it going to reopen, or is it going to reopen? Mm-hmm. And the good news is it is, but not until next year. All right, thanks, Devin. Philip, let's turn to you. Fundraising numbers have come out in the election, the various campaigns, and you've been looking at the third district race, in which incumbent John Yarmuth is seeking reelection.
Yes, and the numbers really in every race around here in Kentucky seem somewhat lopsided. But here in Kentucky's third congressional race, which is the seat currently held by Congressman John Yarmuth, Federal Election Commission reports for the first 3 months of this year show Yarmuth raised over $80,000 in contributions. He has about $432,000 in his campaign savings or in cash on hand. Compared to his opponent in the general election, who will be Brooks Wicker, who's unopposed in the GOP primary, Wicker's only raised about $3,000 in the first 3 months of the year. And he only has, according to FEC reports, $634 in his campaign coffers. Now, for math majors, that's a 681-to-1 ratio in favor of Congressman Yarmuth. I confronted Brooks Wicker about this. He says that he hasn't been raising money in the first 3 months because he doesn't have any primary opponents. If you remember, 2 years ago, the third district campaign for the GOP primary was very crowded. This year, it's only one person running, that being Mr. Wicker. He says that allows him to get some things into order, so he's not really focused on fundraising. He told me to pay attention to the June FEC reports, which will be in the second quarter. So at this point, Congressman Yarmuth has a wide lead, to say the least, in fundraising, in a race that many people sort of are not paying attention to and saying that it's a foregone conclusion. And Yarmuth is the favorite, and it's a safe Democratic seat this year in 2012.
So Wicker says he's not been actively fundraising, but is he serious about his candidacy?
He's a serious candidate. As I said, he ran 2 years ago in that crowded GOP primary that Todd Lally ended up winning. He has some serious viewpoints. It's just a matter of, you know, if his fundraising can't pick up at all, he won't be able to get on TV. It'll be hard for him to be able to pay staff. And against someone like Congressman Yarmuth, who's proven time and again that he's able to raise money and in many instances. I asked Mr. Wicker also if maybe the Republicans were going to give him any help. He said he has been in conversation with the Republican National Committee that deals with Congress, not saying that they're going to give him any support one way or the other, but he is confident that this will be a serious race. But most political observers believe that this will be an easy race for Congressman Yarmuth. It's a safe seat for him, and it'll be a pretty big victory come November. But Mr. Wicker obviously disagrees.
Right. All right. Thank you, Philip. Erica, let's turn to you. As you reported, Kentuckian Wendell Berry honored this week in Washington. He became the 41st Jefferson Lecturer in the Humanities. And what does this honor mean?
Well, this is basically the highest honor the federal government gives in the humanities. It's a lecture. It comes with, I believe, a $10,000 honorarium. And this is the 41st year they've done it. It's, you know, there have been some pretty distinguished people who have been chosen for this award. Last year was Drew Gilpin Faust, the historian. John Irving was awarded one. Toni Morrison. So it's a pretty high honor.
Mr. Berry, of course, a man of letters, an activist, does a lot of things. Identified with Kentucky. Why was he chosen for this?
Well, I think the way they describe him mostly is a farmer poet, which you know, his full range of talents is kind of a long list. He's, you know, poetry, prose, farmer, very, very big on using the land correctly, environmentalist, activist. He was chosen basically for all of these things. They described in the press release, Jim Leach, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, described him as a modern-day Henry David Thoreau, seeing as someone who has a lot that can teach about conservation and the land, as well as somebody who is, you know, very well respected in literary communities as well. And it was interesting when I spoke with Chairman Leach several months ago when they made this announcement, and he said that he thought Wendell Berry's speech might be a little controversial. I mean, obviously, Mr. Berry has taken positions on, most recently, things like mountaintop removal that not everyone agree with. But he said what's important is that not that you agree with his position on things, but you can still learn from him, even if you disagree on those key points.
So he has delivered the lecture. What did he talk about?
Well, as predicted, it was I won't say controversial, but it was such that Chairman Leach did get up afterwards and state that, you know, Mr. Berry's views did not represent the views of the U.S. government. but he basically gave a speech called "It All Turns on Affection," where he kind of wove his family's story of basically being farmers who were treated badly by tobacco monopolies into a story of and a message of a kinder economy, one that's not all bent on, you know, money and being successful. He argued that that people have let corporations basically assume that land and its people can be separated with no consequences.
Mm-hmm. If farmers come under adversity from high costs and low prices, then they must either increase their demands upon the land or they must sell out and move to town. And this is supposed to involve no ecological or economic or social cost.
And in the speech, Berry rejected that notion and said, you know, you can't separate a land from its people. He also, one thing that I thought was kind of interesting, he used, one of his teachers, self-described teachers and mentors, was Wallace Stegner. And Wallace Stegner was big on this concept of boomers and stickers, which is something that Berry also referred to a lot in his speech.
The boomer is motivated by greed, the desire for money, property, and therefore power. Stickers, on the contrary, are motivated by affection, by such love for a place and its life that they want to preserve it and remain in it.
And so in this kind of message, you know, Berry kind of bemoaned that land is treated as expendably as natural resources like coal and oil, and said we're all kind of complicit in this, but it's something that we can work to return to kind of an earlier time where we treated the land with respect.
And there's, of course, a way online for us to hear this if we haven't heard it yet.
Yes, we have a link on this story. If you go to WFPL.org, search on Wendell Berry, there are a number of stories, but the one that talks about his address has a link to the whole video.
All right. Thank you, Erica. Devin, back to you. You reported this week that Eastern Kentucky's largest health care provider is suing the state and two managed care operators MCOs for short, mm-hmm. for failing to manage the new privatized Medicaid system. What's going on there?
This is the first really big challenge that the new MCOs have seen. And last year is when the state privatized Medicaid. So now there's three major statewide MCOs or Medicaid or managed care operators who basically oversee the Medicaid operations. Earlier this year, the three MCOs testified against some allegations that they weren't paying their healthcare providers on time. Essentially, what happens is if you're a hospital, you send away for a certain rate for Medicaid, and then you get paid by formerly the state. Now it's these MCOs. They said in February that they fixed the problem, but just last week, Appalachian Regional Healthcare filed a suit against Kentucky Spirit and Coventry Cares. Kentucky Spirit actually does not have a contract with Appalachian Regional Healthcare, and they are the biggest Eastern Kentucky healthcare provider. And by the state law, you're supposed to give adequate care to the whole region. Otherwise, you have to basically reimburse anybody who goes to Appalachian Regional Healthcare a full rate. Well, the state did something really funny. So says the former Medicaid Commissioner Shannon Turner. They basically exempted the MCOs from having to pay the full rate for out-of-network care. So the Appalachian Regional basically opened up a lawsuit against Kentucky Spirit saying, you don't have adequate care in our area, you owe us this full fee. And against Coventry, they're essentially saying that you haven't been paying us on time. And when the contract expires, which is next week, they haven't made a new contract. So they're going to be in a similar position as Kentucky Spirit. And again, Shannon Turner, for the former Medicaid commissioner, I spoke with her earlier this week, and she was saying that the lawsuits are really challenging the statewide privatized care and the on-time payments. So it'll be really interesting to see what's decided in this suit, because the state is under some federal obligation, yet they seem to be exempt in some circumstances.
A lot of these hospitals depend on Medicaid funds to really stay
afloat. Thousands of people in Eastern Kentucky. And Ms. Turner said that the patient care isn't really likely to change too much. But if you think about it, if the hospital struggles financially, some of that may trickle down as far as not being able to update equipment or maybe not being able to update, add more doctors. Things like that is a real concern to Appalachian Regional.
And I think you mentioned this. This is the first such suit filed.
Yes, correct. They're basically asking an injunction because, as I said, next week Coventry Cares agreement expires, but we have yet to hear from the courts if they're going to be receiving that.
All right. Thanks, Devin. Back to you, Philip. You reported this week that U.S. Senator Rand Paul is thinking about making an endorsement. And this 4th District congressional race up north is really getting heated. And he is thinking about making an endorsement after two high-profile fellow Republicans made their recommendations public.
Yeah, Congressman Jeff Davis and former U.S. Senator Jim Bunning, they put their support behind State Representative Alicia Webb Edgington in the crowded GOP race for the congressional district and the 4th congressional district here in Kentucky, which Jeff Davis is stepping down from. He's retiring this year. Many had expected that Davis was going to stay out of the race, but after Thomas Massie, another candidate in the GOP race, put out an ad that sort of misled voters to making them appear that Davis was endorsing Massie when really he was just praising him in a House floor speech, mm-hmm. many people felt that encouraged Davis to step out there and get involved in the race. Now Senator Paul, who was closely associated with Massie, I believe Mr. Massie worked on his campaign back in 2010. Several of Massie's campaign folks supported or worked with Senator Paul's office. So you see Senator Paul now saying, well, through a surrogate, through his chief of staff, that the senator doesn't like the fact that these two individuals, meaning Bunning and Davis, supported Webb Edgington. So now he's thinking about getting in the race. Oddly enough, there is a campaign event scheduled by Massie next Monday with Senator Paul. He hasn't answered questions if that is going to be an endorsement. He just said, well, we'll have to wait and see. Everyone knows it'll pretty much be Senator Paul endorsing Massie in that campaign event. So that campaign is becoming more and more interesting by the day. I think that we'll see once the Paul endorsement comes down, if it comes down on Monday, the question will be for Gary Moore, who's another high-profile candidate in the race, who will he have left as far as endorsements? He's already gotten a couple of key group endorsements, but it's more and more crowded, and as fundraising totals come in, you see them running even there in fundraising. So it's a pretty closely watched race that's expected to stay in the Republican column.
We're going to be talking to Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston about the involvement of a super PAC in this race as the plot thickens here. I've lost my train of thought. If I was going to ask you a follow-up question. Oh, a very crowded field. What, seven Republicans?
Yeah, you have seven Republicans in this race, not just Webb Edgington, Moore, and Massey, but Marcus Carey, who's a lawyer. You have several, and because the district has changed, too, as well, I think people forget that now, because of what happened with redistricting in the General Assembly, District 4 in Kentucky now represents parts of eastern Jefferson mm-hmm. County. So folks here in Louisville who used to be represented by John Yarmuth are now represented by Jeff Davis, and they're going to have their say-so in that GOP primary as well. So that could influence the race a slight bit. Certain poll numbers show that Webb Edgington is more favored in the Louisville part of the district than other parts. So that could change the dynamics a little bit. But there's no real clear front runner anymore, although Massey is still assumed to be the favorite because of the backing from Senator Paul.
All right. Thanks, Philip. Erica, back to you. You reported this week that in response to complaints of coal ash dust at the LG&E's Cane-run power plant, the company has announced plans that it will build a screen near the landfill. What's this screen supposed to do?
Do you ever get tired of talking about coal ash, Rick?
No, not yet.
Well, I should probably say before, like I have to say every week, coal ash is the byproduct of burning coal for electricity. Yeah. And it's something that LG&E and other power companies generally have to stockpile in some way near their power plants or on other sites. In this case, this is a big screen. It's 50 feet tall. It's about 200. It's supposed to be finished today. About 223 feet long. That's about 2/3 the length of a football field. And it will go on the company's property, kind of around the coal ash landfill, in between the landfill and the houses on the other side of the road. And it was described by the company as being kind of like a furnace filter, mm-hmm. where it'll let air through, but it'll catch the dust. And I called the company that's providing it. It's called Action Sports Netting. It's a Florida-based company, and they're actually a company that makes nets for golf courses and tennis courts primarily. They do some landfill fencing as well. They've never done one for a power plant before. That along with some other things kind of raised a couple eyebrows. I guess residents will have to wait and see how it works.
Yeah, I saw a picture of it, and it reminds me of the net they have out at the driving range where my son and I go to.
Yeah, and the company, the company said they have basically different, visibility screens where you can choose whether you want it to be, totally solid or mm-hmm. some fraction in between. So
has there been any reaction from people who live around the area?
Yeah, well, people who live around it are kind of, they're, on one hand, they want this problem to be over. They hope it works. They hope that it keeps the ash coming onto their properties. On another hand, a slightly more cynical hand, they wonder if this is basically just a screen to block their visibility of the problem. They've been pretty active videotaping dust flying off of the landfill, and turning that tape over to the city and saying, look, here's a problem. And so they wonder, obviously it's a lot easier to see a cloud of dust when it's coming out of a machine rather than, when it's already kind of dispersed and flown over a fence. So they're wondering if this is meant to block their view.
The metro government has been involved in this to a certain degree. What, any reaction from them?
Yeah, well, they reached a settlement on some previous coal ash violations with the company last week, and this is not part of that settlement. The metro government, the Air Pollution Control District, wanted to make clear they did not ask LG&E to do this, for better or for worse. They are very careful to say they don't know how it's going to affect the coal ash. They didn't ask the company to do this. So they're waiting to see if it works, too. And they've said that they're going to keep pursuing this. If there are more violations, there will be more notices of violations and more penalties.
All right. Thanks, Erica. Philip, back to you. Let's go back to Congressman Yarmuth, some non-election news. The congressman pledged this week to vote against Republican-sponsored legislation that would freeze interest rates on federal student loans. This is an issue that's been hit back and forth recently. He called the plan a cynical ploy against two vulnerable groups. What's he talking about?
Yeah, and just to give everyone an update, the House did just approve the GOP plan.
Really?
To freeze those interest loan rates, despite President Obama's threat to veto the legislation. The reason Congressman Yarmuth called the plan a ploy, and the reason that the administration is vetoing a plan, which they just rallied, the president just rallied earlier this week at three college campuses to freeze the student loan rates, Congressman Yarmuth points out that if you look at the way the Republicans pay for the interest rates, the Stafford loans are set to increase from 3.4% to 6.8%. They want to pay for it by cutting what Speaker John Boehner has called a slush fund in the president's health care law. And in the Affordable Care Act, this fund takes care of a lot of issues with care. It helps states and cities take care of situations like strokes, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and a lot of women's care programs as well. It's about $6 billion. So that's how Republicans want to pay for it. Cut that $6 billion from the health care law, and you can use that money to help pay for the continuation of cutting the interest rates. The Democrats, obviously, in the House and President Obama feel that, no, that's not the way we should go. It should either be by raising taxes on the wealthiest of Americans via the payroll tax, Social Security tax, or closing loopholes for oil companies and other subsidies to those energy companies as well. So we're basically seeing the same debate from the shutdown, from the other budget discussions, that trickling over into the student loan situation. The House obviously passed in a close 215 to 195 vote just about an hour or so ago. So that plan will likely go to the Senate, where it will die, or even if it makes it past the Senate, because there's a Senate version, it will be vetoed by President Obama. Senate Democrats have introduced their own version of the plan, which I said earlier will pay for it by raising taxes on the wealthy and closing those loopholes to oil companies. So Congressman Yarmuth has some pretty harsh words for Republicans, saying that you're pitting two groups against each other, students versus seniors, whether we should help students with their student loans or we should help seniors with their some of the indigent care issues. So for the congressman and other Democrats, that was sort of a no deal, no bargain at the beginning. And you saw that in how close the vote was today.
And Governor Beshear has been chiming in on this as well today.
Yeah, surprisingly so, considering the fact that Governor Beshear has kept, for the most part, some of President Obama's ideas at arm's length during the gubernatorial bid, as Kenny Colston pointed out today in his reporting. You saw the governor sign and write a letter to all members of Kentucky's federal delegation, our six congressmen, our two senators, urging them to support the legislation. Not really clear on if he was supporting the GOP plan or the Senate Democrat plan, but simply telling them, like most folks, hey, make sure this happens so we can keep college affordable for students in Kentucky. I believe the average cost, if this rates double, will be $942 per student in Kentucky. At least that's the information that the governor's office and the White House put out.
And finally, switching over to the Senate and Senator McConnell, you've been reporting that he's not been feeling the love from conservative activist Eric Erickson. What's going on there?
For those of you who watch CNN, you probably are familiar with Eric Erickson. He's a conservative activist, also the editor of redstate.com. And despite what many people on the liberal side of the aisle feel about Senator McConnell, it's not all monolithic on the conservative side. Eric Erickson and others are very critical of the senator, saying that he's not conservative enough. In fact, that he hasn't really pushed a conservative agenda hard enough in the U.S. Senate as the GOP leader there. He's come out with some pretty harsh attacks. Now, not all conservative activists believe this. Grover Norquist, of course, believes and supports Senator McConnell's leadership. But Erickson has been really taking it to Senator McConnell. McConnell was asked about this on Laura Ingraham, another talk radio show host, on her show this week. He sort of acted like he didn't even know who Eric Erickson was. In fact, he said, who is Eric Erickson? And whoever he is, he doesn't have a large enough audience for me to even care about. She then pointed out that not only does he have a popular blog among conservatives, but he appears on CNN quite frequently. And then soon as that appearance ended, Eric Erickson took to his blog pretty quickly and once again smashed Senator McConnell, saying he's more of an appropriator than a Republican. And many people point out this is getting pretty personal, but not everyone likes Senator McConnell, even on the conservative aisle. So there's some agreement there. He's made some folks angry on both sides of the aisle, it seems.
All right, that's going to wrap up our WFPL roundtable. Thanks to Philip M. Bailey, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama for joining us. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Heldet. This week, the Kentucky Supreme Court heard arguments in a case challenging the legality of instant racing. That's the game approved for use at Kentucky horse tracks. The critics say it's just a thinly disguised casino game. And here to talk about the instant racing and the case is Kenny Colston from the Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau. Kenny, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick.
Just for those who don't know, and just to review, exactly what is the instant racing game?
Instant racing is kind of a half slots, half horse racing betting game, depending on who you ask will tell you what it's more like. Basically, it looks like a slot machine. It even has, I think, like the three spinning wheels on it. But at the same time, what people do is you sit down, you put in your quarter. What you're actually betting on is a historical race. I mean, you could be betting on Secretariat in the Derby. The thing is that it doesn't say horse number five is Secretariat. It says just horse number five. It gives you odds, what the horse odds are. It tells you some historical information about the horses. And then once you pick your horse, you see the last 3 seconds of that race on a small little screen in the corner. Basically shows you who wins the race. And if you win, obviously, the money goes to a pool, kind of like pari-mutuel betting, like at the horse race. It all goes into a pool. The thing is, Rick, if me and you were sitting next to each other at these terminals, you would be betting on a completely different race than I'm betting on. And opponents say that that's not necessarily horse, you know, how you bet on horse races. Where if we bet on the same, you know, where you bet on the same race, whether I put a $2 win bet down and you put a $2 show bet down, technically we're all still betting into this on the same race into the same pools. And so there was a lot of arguments at the Court of Appeals level about the game and about that process this week.
Now this game was not approved by the legislature, but by the Horse Racing Commission, right?
That's exactly right. As we all know, the legislature has had a really tough time passing any sort of expanded gambling outside of what Kentucky currently has, which is horse racing and the lottery. And so this did not, the Horse Racing Commission approved this. You know, the Attorney General has ruled on the game, basically saying that it's not pari-mutuel betting. So what happened was, is because the Horse Racing Commission approved it, a bunch of the racetracks and the commission went ahead and filed a lawsuit in Franklin Circuit Court where no one was challenging them. And what they're saying is that there's a precedent that if there's certain controversy over an action, they say there's controversy over this action, everyone can groups can challenge, and they don't have to have kind of an aggressive party against them. Well, the Family Foundation didn't buy that, intervened in the case, but wasn't allowed to ask questions, do any type of discovery or evidentiary hearings. And so basically Franklin Circuit Court ruled that the game was allowed under the same rules that horse racing betting is allowed, and the Family Foundation has appealed that to the Court of Appeals. Three-judge panel heard the case middle of this week, and they say they hope to rule within 6 weeks.
So where's instant racing being used at this point?
It's being used in two places in western Kentucky. At Kentucky Downs, which is basically in Franklin, Kentucky, near the Tennessee line. And the other place is Ellis Park in Henderson. The thing is though, that Ellis Park hasn't installed their terminals yet. Kentucky Downs waited until after the circuit court ruling to install their terminals. But once that ruling came down, they installed theirs. They've actually been seeing a lot of profit from it. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars. It's been very helpful for that small racetrack. Ellis Park, of course, is in danger as well when it comes to finances. They've approved it, but I think they're waiting to see what the Court of Appeals does before they institute their terminals, because they don't want to spend the money and have the Court of Appeals rule that the terminals are illegal, that they're not allowed under the same rules as horse betting. And then, you know, of course, Ellis Park may have spent that money for no reason at all. It would put them at an even more financial disadvantage until they wait for that challenge to be ruled on in the Kentucky Supreme Court, where it's probably most definitely headed no matter what happens in the Court of Appeals.
So when can we expect a decision?
They said between 4 and 6 weeks. You know, it was a 3-judge panel, and you know, it was kind of interesting. It was a more than an hour long hearing, which is uncommon. Usually, these hearings go for an hour, and everyone's kicked out of the courtroom. But this one went longer than that. It seemed like it could go all day if the justices would have let it. And, you know, it's some interesting comments. I mean, some of the justices kind of seemed like they didn't believe that it was really live horse racing, as the Franklin Circuit Court said it was, because it's a video. A few acted like they didn't believe it was legal under current statutes. Others questioned, you know, how things went along at the Franklin Circuit Court, the Family Foundation basically being shut out of asking any questions or doing any motions. But at the same time, there was a reluctance on the other side that, you know, maybe the game is legal, but certain aspects, like the state of Kentucky taxes the game as if they would, you know, horse racing, the tracks, Well, is the maybe the tax isn't legal, but the game is. There's a million questions. It'll be very interesting to see what the Court of Appeals does. But somewhere between a month to 6 weeks is when we can expect them to rule.
Yeah, I should clarify. I said the Supreme Court earlier, but it is the Court of Appeals. It hasn't reached the Supreme Court yet.
That's right.
Let's move on to another topic. You reported about a possible super PAC influence in that 4th District Congressional race.
That's right. It's called the Americans for Growth, Opportunity, and Prosperity, or AmeriGOP. And basically, this group is being funded by one to two wealthy Northern Kentucky businessmen. The PAC has come out firmly and said that they're going to support Thomas Massie in the 4th Congressional race, a district race. And a lot of people, a lot of the other candidates inside the race and a few observers outside the race, are kind of scratching their head because certainly to this point, neither Massie nor the Super PAC have done anything illegal. There's been no complaints filed. But a lot of people are saying, you know, some of the actions just don't line up correctly. Massie spoke at the home of the chief fundraiser of this PAC, a man named Richard Knock. You know, of course, Massie read a disclaimer that he was not there to raise money for the PAC, which is technically legal in this post-Citizens United world. But a lot of, you know, even Republican candidates in the race are saying, you know, this just does not smell right, the relationship between Knock and Massie and the Super PAC.
Massie, it's M-A-S-S-I-E, right? This is not the Massie of coal company fame, correct?
That's right.
So no complaints have been filed in this. So what can we expect anything to happen?
You know, it's tricky because with the Citizens United ruling, there's a lot of loopholes when it comes to super PACs and candidates. It's not illegal for a super PAC to have a candidate at its at a function. President Obama has said he's going to do it. Mitt Romney has done it before. But there's certain rules. They either have to raise in a limited amount or they can't raise funds at all. And so we'll have to see. I mean, if more information comes out about the relationship between Knock and Massie and the Super PAC, there's along the lines of what we reported earlier this week, you know, you could see a report filed. But the one thing the candidates don't want to do is file a false complaint because that's illegal.
Right.
Or two, make a statement that says X candidate coordinated, because then they could be slapped with a lawsuit, and that just gets messy. And the second thing is the way that most government agencies work, even if one of the other candidates were to file a complaint with the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, there's probably little chance that that case would be solved before the May 22nd primary. So what good does it do is the kind of the question they have.
And finally, before we let you go, there have been some indications that the this audit of former Ag Commissioner Richie Farmer is wrapping up.
Yes, that's right. Monday, the office, auditor's office, Adam Edelin, will be releasing this audit. Republican Agriculture Commissioner James Comer, who asked for the audit, will be there as well. Based on the news stories to date, you wouldn't think that this news is going to be good for former Agriculture Commissioner Richie Farmer. And you're talking about paying for hotel rooms. You're talking about, you know, apparently some rifles from a conference, this lavish conference that the department spent a lot of money on in Lexington when it said it didn't have any money. I just see no way, no how that any good news is going to come out of this for Richie Farmer on Monday.
Kenny Colston is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
This is State of the News on WFPL. There's been a lot of discussion recently here in Louisville lately about jailhouse informants, particularly those who went early release from detention for providing information to prosecutors. One such informant, Jason Mallory, is now charged in the murder of a 15-year-old Louisville boy. He allegedly committed the crime after winning early release for cooperating with the prosecutors on other cases. And here to talk about it is Jason Riley from the Courier-Journal. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm fine. It's James Mallory, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
James Mallory. Your name's Jason. Sorry
yes.
about that. Well, Mallory's one of three people charged with the murder of 15-year-old Gregory Holt, right?
Yes. Mr. Mallory came up about a month ago in another case, a guy by the name of John Jones, a murder case. Mr. Mallory supposedly had bombshell information about in the John Jones case and several other cases, and he was released on shock probation out of a robbery case on his own, so he could, as a sort of an agreement that he would testify against these other people. So he was let out in February, and he was supposed to testify in the John Jones case last week or the week before. And when he arrived to testify, he was arrested and charged with this murder of the 15-year-old.
So how common is it for prosecutors to use the information given to them by jailhouse informants?
It's pretty common. I've been covering the courthouse for about 8 years, and I've actually was looking for an interesting case to write about because there have been a lot of these informants in the last year in high-profile cases, and I was looking for sort of an interesting one to write about when Mr. Mallory came along a month or two ago, and he was very interesting because defense attorneys tried to do something that had not been done here before. They said to the judge in the John Jones case, this guy is so unreliable, judge, we want you to have a hearing on him, and you verify what he's trying to say before you let a jury hear it. We don't think he's reliable in any way. We want you to get to the bottom of it. Other states have these things called reliability hearings, but Kentucky doesn't have them. The judge did not allow it because it hasn't really been done here. I think a lot more people will be asking for it. But Mr. Mallory also did a few odd things after he was called as a witness in this John Jones case. He eventually went and talked to Mr. Jones. When he got released to testify, he went to the jail and talked to Mr. Jones.
Mm-hmm.
He also ended up denying to me and other members of the media and the judge in the John Jones case that he had made any kind of deal with prosecutors at all. He's turned into a real headache for prosecutors. And when he did finally go testify in the Jones case, he said he didn't know anything about the case. He had made no deal with prosecutors. He was not a snitch, not a rat, and basically refused to testify. And now, obviously, he's in jail for another murder. So it's unclear if he's going to be called to testify in any of these other cases or if they even want to call him. The prosecutors didn't even end up calling him in the John Jones case. It was defense attorneys who called him and sort of used him as against the prosecution.
Now, you've talked to James Mallory, right?
I did an interview with Mr. Mallory in jail a few days ago, and he denies still that he had anything to do with being a snitch. He said the judge let him out on shock probation. It was just the judge's decision. Didn't have anything to do with his having an agreement with prosecutors. He denies anything to do with the murder of the 15-year-old. And he says he's not a snitch. So,
now, he was recommended for early release by a prosecutor, Tom Van der Rostein, if I'm saying
yes.
That correctly. Now, Gregory Holt's family members obviously upset, calling on him to be fired.
Right. Dave Stengel, the head of the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, Commonwealth Attorney, has come out in behind Mr. Van der Rossi and said he didn't do anything wrong. He said a lot of time prosecutors have to make these deals with witnesses because it's so hard to get people to come forward. So they make these deals to get information just because a lot of times it's just a lack of witnesses, and that Mr. Van der Rostein couldn't have foreseen what allegedly would happen and didn't do anything wrong. And he's not going to be fired. He's not going to be punished. Van der Rostein's a very good prosecutor. He's not had a great week, but
yeah.
He's also running for Commonwealth Attorney.
That's right.
And this is probably certainly not going to help him too much, but his boss and, you know, the other prosecutors are behind him, said this is an awful, they've all called it an awful result.
Yeah. You also wrote, moving on to another topic, about this problem of inmates having access to cell phones, which of course are banned, obviously, if you're behind bars.
Mm-hmm. Yes, banned even for the people that work in jails and prisons. And that came up in another case, another murder case, a guy by the name of Zachary Kilgore, who's charged with murder. It came up that he had been snuck a cell phone allegedly by a Metro Corrections employee and was using this cell phone. And this is according to another snitch who snitched on Mr. Kilgore, that he was making calls with his cell phone inside Metro Corrections to witnesses in his case, threatening or at least trying to set up, talking to somebody who could threaten these witnesses, is the allegation against him. Now, he's not been charged with anything. Promoting contraband is a felony. That's what you could be charged with. He agreed, according to court records we saw, to work with investigators in Metro Corrections on this case and look into the Metro, former Metro Corrections employee, LaRon Stoner, who allegedly gave him the phone. Mr. Stoner left Metro Corrections right before the investigation started and went to the Louisville Metro Police Department. He was a candidate. He wasn't officially part of the police department, but was fired when this came out, and he refused to take a lie detector test as to whether he did or not. He's actually called me and said he didn't have anything to do. LaRon Stoner didn't have anything to do with getting Zachary Kilgore a phone. But we decided not only to look at this case, but to sort of look at Kentucky in general. It's a nationwide problem. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to see what it was like in Kentucky. And I wouldn't say it's a huge problem in Kentucky right now, but it's growing. They went from 2006, they found seven cell phones with inmates, to last year was 40, or no, 2010 was 40, and last year was up to 80. So it's a growing problem. It's still a lot smaller than other states, in part because some of our prisons, you just can't get cell reception.
Right.
So it doesn't do them any good.
Yeah, exactly.
But they do acknowledge it's growing. It's a problem. Inmates are finding creative ways to get past mm-hmm. security. So, you know, they're throwing them, people are throwing them over the into the yard, the jail yard, so people can walk around and get them, or shooting them in with potato guns,
oh,
or
goodness.
Putting them in the soles of shoes.
So what have, just got a few seconds left here, what are officials doing to try to prevent this from happening?
Well, they have now a canine dog who can sniff out cell phones. They bring in to jails and prisons every month or so. They have, the Metro Corrections here is trying to get a full body scanner. They already have airport-type scanners that they look for them. They do surprise inspections. And one of the things that the state officials want to do is jam cell phone technology, so you just can't use them. But that's right now illegal in the to do that. And the FCC is afraid that it would mess with cell phones around jail and also could prevent emergency calls getting out. So it's not gone anywhere yet.
Jason Riley with the Courier-Journal covers the court system and I'm sure other news. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, after years of study and debate, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs has settled on a proposed site for a new VA hospital in Louisville. Chris Ottz of the Courier-Journal has been covering the developments with the new facility and joins us now. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you.
So there was talk of several locations for a while, downtown, actually using the present location off Zorn Avenue, but another location was picked off Brownsboro Road.
Yes, this is about a 36 to 38-acre site right off Brownsboro Road at the Waterston Expressway. And the main reason that they picked the site, well, a couple. First is that they really heard strongly from veterans that they didn't want to go downtown. And second was that this is a nice, you know, virgin piece of land, basically, where they can build a hospital without the complications of eminent domain or having to tear structures down. And so the construction would be cheaper and go faster.
This is what, like a 21-acre site, something like that?
It's about 36 to 38 mm-hmm. acres. The PVA says 36. The developer says 38. So the estimates vary.
And who owns this property now?
It's an entity called Midlands LLC, but it's basically developer Jonathan Blue of Blue Equity here in town.
Now, there have been some public hearings about the site.
One in particular uh-huh. last week, or April 18th. At Kammerer Middle School, and it was just basically a long parade of folks getting up and mostly saying that they're really concerned about the traffic in the area and that, you know, some other site that has more space might be better for the hospital.
Now, the VA has launched a study of possible traffic potential in the area.
Yes,
right?
Well, it's the study is part of it's a mandatory thing that they have to do. It's an environmental assessment that looks at a whole bunch of other things, but traffic really is the main focus because that is the main issue, the main objection to the site. And so that study is not completed yet, but it should be in the next 3 weeks, maybe a month or so, before they complete that study. And then they can perhaps close on the property, which they say is their plan at this point.
Back to the public hearings for a moment. Dakota Meyer, I understand, was that
yes.
One of them spoke up.
Yeah, that was quite a surprise. I didn't know that he was going to be there. And, you know, I was like, whoa, holy cow. When mm-hmm. I realized who he was, I got my camera out immediately, started recording. You know, Dakota Meyer was the Medal of Honor winner, former Marine who's from Kentucky. And he came basically to say that this whole debate is silly. That people who oppose this hospital who live nearby, that, you know, the inconvenience is nothing compared to the inconvenience that veterans like him went through.
So say everything goes as planned by the Veterans Administration. What could we actually see a hospital built?
2018 is the expected completion date, construction beginning maybe 2014.
And what would happen to the current site on Zorn Avenue?
You know, that's a question that I haven't really looked at. Mm-hmm. They could potentially use it for some clinics they do have other facilities in the area that are not hospital but do provide VA healthcare, basically. No word on that yet.
Has Metro government taken a position on this new site?
The Mayor Fisher says that he thinks that the veterans deserve a new hospital, that he wants it built as fast as possible, and anywhere in Louisville that the VA chooses to go, he will support.
All right. Chris Otts with the Courier-Journal has been covering the proposals for the construction of a VA hospital in Louisville. Chris, thanks again for joining
us. Thank you,
Rick. We're going to turn now to arts, and Aaron Keene is here, of course, our arts and humanities reporter, who has had a busy week with the Louisville Orchestra, finally, after months and months and months of back and forth.
20 months, to be exact,
that many.
20 months,
closer to 14 or so, but it was a long time. But now we have an agreement in place.
We do. The Louisville Orchestra and management and its players have an agreement. They, the players are going to start back to work on June 1st, which is, I think, everyone in the city, at least in the art scene and beyond, is kind of breathing a sigh of relief over this. Finally coming to an end. The agreement is a one-year bridge agreement, but it does include basically the provisions include for and provide for a multi-year agreement coming out of the end of next year. So technically it's a bridge agreement, but that it's going to lay the groundwork for this multi-year agreement. What they're doing is, let's look at the basics of the agreement. Mm-hmm. Our orchestra size is being reduced from 71 players to 57. That's two more than what management had put forth earlier at 55, I think is what they were going for. So 57 seems like, a little more and also probably closer to the number of Louisville Orchestra musicians who are still here in town. A lot of folks left, they've been out of work. So 57 musicians, the season is going to be reduced. They were playing a 37-week season. We're looking at 30-week season now, but their base pay is going to stay their base weekly pay is going to stay the same. But of course, everyone's taking a pay cut because they're working fewer weeks.
Now, there were proposals and counter proposals over the last 20 months. What was it that made it stick this time?
Well, both sides actually at the press conference this week credited Metro Council President Jim King with really bringing both sides together over the last 3 weeks. If you remember earlier in the month, the orchestra was saying we are going to go forward with hiring replacement musicians, which would have had them basically looking outside of American Federation of Musician Union members. We can talk about what a professional musician mm-hmm. means, basically, but you're looking at maybe new conservatory grads or folks who just haven't been working in the professional orchestra world. They had advertised these jobs, and they said that they were moving forward because the organization was dedicated to starting a season this fall. And that was just earlier this month. As far as I know, Jim King got involved about 3 weeks ago and has been serving as a sort of intermediary between the two parties. And apparently he was the one who was able to finally bring them both together.
Now, there was this unfair list that the Kentucky Opera was on, and the orchestra, of course, the musicians put them on this list because of,
Yes. Well, so the Louisville Orchestra is on the American Federation of Musicians is the national union. The Louisville Orchestra was on the unfair list mm-hmm. For their part in the labor dispute. And you get on the list when your local union recommends an organization be put on the list to the national union. So, it's assumed that it's pretty much just a technicality, like we fax in a form to get the orchestra off the unfair list. But then the question was, will the Kentucky Opera stay on the unfair list as well? The musicians recommended they be placed on the unfair list last fall when they... I don't know. It's a little. It's sort of strange technicalities here. It's hard to explain, but the Kentucky Opera contracts with the Louisville Orchestra mm-hmm. to play live for their productions, and last November for the production of the Marriage of Figaro, the opera said, we would like to contract with you, even though you're not playing for the orchestra right now. There's been no season, but we would like to contract you with you for your union published opera rates. And the musicians said, no, we want to be paid under the terms of our expired
labor contract, which the opera had done for the previous production of Carmen, and it just proved to be prohibitively expensive. Mm-hmm. So the opera said, well, we can't do it. They had a harpsichord accompanist for The Marriage of Figaro, and then for The Merry Widow, for their last production, they hired in community musicians.
So is the possibility that just we had a few seconds left that they could be taken off the unfair list?
Yes, that is most likely what is going to happen here. All they need to do is say, they've said, yes, we want to hire the Louisville Orchestra for our next season. The orchestra has said, yes, we want to play for the opera. So right now it's technicalities, and that is going to happen.
All right, Aaron Keene, thanks for joining us. Before we wrap up today's show, here's a quick program note. In 2 weeks, we're going to launch a retooled version of State of the News. It's called Byline. We'll have our regular interviews with people who cover the news in our community, but we'll also be placing a greater emphasis on some of the big stories that we cover and talk to some of the newsmakers and get more of your input. We're very excited about it, and we think you will be too. Byline debuts in 2 weeks here on WFPL. That's all the time we have for today's State of the News. State of the News is produced by the WFPL news staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Hallett. Have a good weekend.